It's 6:06 at this hour. Villanova students and fans are gathered at the campus football stadium to welcome home the championship Wildcats team. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Meanwhile, a victory parade is set for Center City, Philadelphia, Friday afternoon at 1. Mayor Jim Kenney says the parade will embark from 20th and Market Streets and proceed to City Hall's Dilworth Plaza, where it will end in a rally.
We offered Philadelphia as a venue, and we wanted to make sure that they thought it through and wanted to find out what they wanted to do and they won the championship. It's we're the venue, but they're the team and the school.
Villanova will pick up most of the parade costs. The mayor says the balance will be offset by parade attendees coming into town from the suburbs. A fast-moving plan to restrict abortions in Pennsylvania cleared a first hurdle in the state house yesterday. From WHYY's health desk, Tanya English reports.
The proposal would ban most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. That's 4 weeks earlier than the current state law. The bill would also prohibit a common second trimester procedure called dilation and evacuation. Maria Gallagher with the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation says anti-abortion activists have another name for the procedure.
There has been a debate nationwide about dismemberment abortions, and when people find out what goes on in a dismemberment abortion, the fact that the arms and the legs of the unborn children are torn from the mother, they're appalled.
Planned Parenthood and other opponents say the bill would make Pennsylvania's abortion rules the most restrictive across the country. Erica Goldblatt Hyatt says the proposal would also eliminate an option her family needed. When doctors said her unborn son was developing without an airway, Goldblatt Hyatt says at first, abortion was not an option.
I thought, absolutely not. This is my first child. He's wanted, and I will do anything to keep him.
Soon after, tests revealed that if her son survived, he would likely never breathe on his own or gain consciousness. Goldblatt Hyatt and her husband decided on an abortion just after her 20th week of pregnancy.
I really viewed that as my first parenting decision.
The abortion restriction has already cleared the House Health Committee. The full Pennsylvania House could vote on the plan this week. Governor Tom Wolf has said he would veto it. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Atlantic City will most likely avert a government shutdown after all. A city council vote tomorrow is expected to shift public workers from a two-week pay period to a month-long schedule, and that would keep the city open. But even if it approves this plan, the city is still not out of the woods. Here's WHYY's Joe Hernandez.
It's been a hectic year for Atlantic City, and this is a big week. The city plans to pay public workers on Friday, run out of money, and then stay broke until early May when it receives its quarterly tax payments. Complicating matters is a lawsuit filed by Governor Chris Christie, who wants some of that money to go to the local school district.
Atlantic City had been using property tax collections held in trust for the school district to fund city operations and their extraordinarily rich public sector union contracts, rather than send those dollars to the school children where they rightfully belong. And this has to stop.
A government shutdown this week is unlikely, but if Atlantic City has to pay more to its school district and has less money for workers' salaries, a shutdown could still be possible. But even if the suit goes nowhere and Atlantic City starts paying workers month to month, it will be broke again by July, City Council President Marty Small.
After that, there are no tax revenues and, you know, hopefully everything will be settled by then.
Small hopes the extra time gives state and local leaders a chance to reach a solution. And that state takeover you've been hearing about, it hasn't happened yet. Some state lawmakers oppose a provision that would let the state cancel public worker union contracts. It's being held up in the state assembly, which has a voting session on Thursday. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
President Barack Obama's major climate change initiative, known as the Clean Power Plan, is currently in legal limbo as federal courts decide its fate. The goal? To cut down emissions from existing power plants by about one-third over the next 15 years. It would mean closing hundreds of coal-fired plants and shifting the grid to more renewable forms of energy. Each state is supposed to come up with its own path to accomplish this. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more on what the legal battle means for the fate of the plan in the Commonwealth.
I come from Western Pennsylvania, and it's just breaking our hearts to watch 300 men at a time get shut down because our coal plants can't meet the Clean Power Plan.
At a recent state budget hearing, Republican Representative Jeff Pyle of Armstrong County questioned why Governor Tom Wolf is still allowing state environmental regulators to keep working on the plan.
I also noted that smoke signals coming out of the administration says we're going to go ahead and comply with this, even though the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional.
Actually, that didn't happen. The plan has not been declared unconstitutional. Instead, earlier this year, in a split 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court issued a temporary stay. Basically, it means the plan can't move forward until the legal challenges to it are sorted out. John Quigley heads the State Department of Environmental Protection. He says Pennsylvania should keep working on it, even though the future is uncertain.
And one potential outcome of the stay is that if the rule survives intact and the 2018 submission date survives intact, we'd have less time to plan if we stopped.
Quigley says about 5 employees at DEP are spending part of their time on it. And whether the plan lives or dies, he says the grid is already undergoing major changes. Cheap natural gas is overtaking coal in electric power generation, and the cost of renewable energy is dropping rapidly.
It just makes good business sense to continue to plan for what we know is going to happen. This is inevitable. It's smart for Pennsylvania if we're going to maintain our role as an energy exporter.
Wolf recently vetoed a bill passed by the Republican-led legislature, which would have given lawmakers more oversight in the process. Environmental advocates like Rob Altenberg of Penn Future saw the bill as a delay tactic that would ultimately leave Pennsylvania with fewer options.
If a state chooses not to or is unable to submit a timely plan, then a federal plan will apply. And I know of no state that really would prefer a federal plan over a state-specific plan.
And while the political battle in the U.S. continues, the world's scientists are all pretty much on the same page.
The more we learn, the more we see that action is vital and action sooner is vital. So we really do need to address this issue, and we need to address it quickly.
Altenberg spoke to several hundred college students at a recent forum on the Clean Power Plan in Harrisburg. His message resonated with young people like Elizabeth Placencia. She's graduating from Dickinson College in Carlisle this spring and heading back home to California to work in science communication.
I'm really interested in how do we inform the community, and more importantly, like the lay person on these issues, because it's definitely something that's going to affect everyone, no matter how much money you make or where you live.
Her generation is inheriting a problem it didn't create. She says she often talks to older people, including members of her own family, who feel ambivalent and think that climate change will just sort itself out.
But I think it's important for them to also be on board because they are voters and they're also emitters. So like everyone has a right and a potential to make change. And so when I have these conversations with, like, you know, some uncles or some aunts who are just like, meh, I just like encourage them to just like really think about their carbon footprint.
The sudden and unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia now leaves the Clean Power Plan with a court divided evenly between liberals and conservatives. But whatever the U.S. and Pennsylvania decide to do next, climate scientists say even the historic deal signed by nearly 200 countries in Paris late last year will cut greenhouse gas emissions only by about half of what's needed to avoid an increase of 2 degrees Celsius, at which point, they note, devastating consequences become unstoppable. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Still ahead. The Philadelphia Museum of Art will spread its artistic wealth into neighborhoods throughout the region by installing reproductions of paintings in outdoor public places.
Reaching out and in turn seeing the communities reach back to us has been remarkably gratifying.
Viewing art in unexpected places when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Consider for just a moment burglars and the buildings they choose.
Criminals are finding ways into our buildings, so we respond by getting things like timers on our lights or extra locks on the front door. And it's this endless arms race that's been going on for centuries and if not even millennia.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Turns out architecture in some cities is more burglar-friendly than others. The story next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only study visual arts, music, and crafts, but contribute to the community as a whole by taking part in festivals, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering campus tours on April 20th and May 18th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The sources and effects of lead poisoning have been known for a very long time. Yesterday, we heard biographer Lydia Denworth's story of the Philadelphia doctor who documented the IQ deficits and learning disabilities that even small amounts of lead can cause in children. As Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra continues the narrative, in the 1970s, Dr. Herbert Needleman conducts a study that finds children who had high lead levels in their teeth, where the metal is stored, had lower IQ scores, as well as poorer language function and poorer attention, even though they'd never been identified as having high exposure to lead.
The findings are controversial. Critics, including companies that make lead products, say these things can be caused by other factors, like family life and education. Denworth explains.
A kid in the inner city has all kinds of problems, right? They said the lead is one teeny piece of this, and the effect is minimal, even if there was any effect at all. And Needleman thought any effect at all was criminal.
The research has an impact. The Environmental Protection Agency has already started phasing lead out of gasoline, and in the 80s, thanks in part to Needleman's research, it speeds that up. There's also a federal ban on lead pipes. And then the government puts out a plan to eliminate lead poisoning for good. It says more children should be tested for lead, and that we need to get lead out of kids' homes so they're never poisoned in the first place. Needleman testifies in front of Congress in support of a bill that would fund those efforts.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Herbert Needleman.
His hair is gray now, and he's wearing wire-rimmed glasses and a beige suit.
There is a broad consensus on the part of everybody except the lead industry and its spokesman that lead is extremely toxic at extremely low doses.
He calls removing lead from gasoline a public health triumph, but he says there's more work to do. The idea of getting the lead out of homes, there's a lot of resistance to it from landlords and realtors who say it's too expensive. The bill and others like it don't pass Congress. In 1992, Congress does pass a law requiring landlords to disclose lead paint hazards to tenants, but it can be hard to enforce. In the meantime, Needleman's worried about something else. A couple scientists who represent the lead industry in lawsuits accuse him of scientific misconduct. They say he cherry-picked his data to prove a point. Here he is talking about that accusation in the PBS documentary.
If you're found guilty of scientific misconduct, you're out of business. Your reputation is ruined. You're through.
The University of Pittsburgh, where he's working, investigates for almost a year and finds no scientific misconduct. It says Needleman mischaracterized some of the procedures in his study, but not in a way that changes the findings. As time goes on, more and more studies show effects of lead at low levels. But government agencies stop talking about eliminating lead poisoning entirely. Some people say public health dollars are better spent on other problems, like obesity and diabetes. People make that argument today, too. Lead levels in young children have dropped by more than 90% since the late 70s, when Needleman did his first studies. But a lot of kids are still exposed to lead, through dust, old paint, and pipes. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says no amount of lead in the blood has been proven safe. Denworth says Needleman always felt like we hadn't done enough.
It became old news. We thought we'd solved the problem, and we never really were willing to finish it.
And that's why, despite all that's changed, kids still show up at the doctor with lead in their blood. And like Needleman back in the 50s, there's only so much that doctor can do. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Starting this week, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will display masterpieces from its collection in neighborhoods and towns throughout the region. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that this is the second year the museum will install high-quality reproductions of paintings in outdoor public places.
Last summer, the Philadelphia Art Museum's Inside Out program installed life-size reproductions of famous paintings in unusual places, like at a dog park or in front of a bar. The museum works with community partners to determine which paintings should go where. CEO Timothy Rubb says of all the museum's outreach programs, this one gets the most enthusiastic response from his staff.
Sometimes the simplest gestures are the most profound and the most important. Reaching out and in turn seeing the communities reach back to us has been remarkably gratifying.
Rubb was speaking in front of people representing Doylestown, Narberth, Lansdowne, Coatesville, Old City, and the Tacony neighborhood, each of which will have about a dozen art reproductions installed on their streets this summer, in front of public buildings, parks, banks, even a beer distributor in Narberth.
I hope we provided the appropriate image for you. Last year, in front of a bar, we had our Manet de Van Bach, which is a man drinking beer. I hope we've done it again. We have. That's good.
Even other museums are getting bounty from the Philadelphia Art Museum. Outside the Michener Museum in Doylestown will be a masterpiece by the Bucks County Impressionist Daniel Garber. It's a portrait of the artist's daughter. The original painting is currently on temporary loan inside the Michener. The mayor of Doylestown, Ron Strauss, calls it a perfect marriage.
The Michener actually has trained docents about the works of art as well as about some of the history of Doylestown, and they are offering walking tours.
The reproductions will be up until July, and then in August, a second phase will install paintings on the streets of Bristol, Jenkintown, Conshohocken, Phoenixville, and Upper Darby. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
This evening, Blanca Ziska, the artistic director of the Wilma Theater in Center City, Philadelphia, is attending a ceremony in New York to receive an award that took her by surprise, the $100,000 Vilcek Prize, given to an immigrant, artist, or scientist with a record of major achievement. Ziska fled from her native Czechoslovakia and settled with her then-husband Yuri in Philadelphia, where the couple established the Wilma 35 years ago. The theater has evolved into a major player in the city's cultural makeup. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro sat down with Ziska to talk about her award and her work.
Blanca Ziska, you have just won a wonderful award of $100,000 from the Vilcek Foundation. Tell us a little about the foundation.
You know, I didn't know anything about the foundation whatsoever when I found out. I got this phone call on my cell phone, and there was some man talking to me in an accent telling me, please call me back. I think I may have a good news for you. And I was thinking, well, maybe there is some money for the Wilma Theater. This would be exciting, new money, right? We are always looking to fundraise more money for the theater. And so I returned the phone call, and he tells me, there is a little bit of money. And I'm like, yeah, great. He's like, but it's for you. It's not going to be for theater. And then he says, $100,000. And I was just completely shocked.
It's an award for an immigrant artist or an immigrant scientist, somebody who has a major achievement in a career or has had a career of major achievements.
So I'm joining the ranks of Baryshnikov, Yo-Yo Ma, and Blanca Ziska.
That's terrific. Go back to that committee room where you weren't even at when the decision was made. What do you think they talked about when they talked about you, Blanca Ziska?
That would be such a speculation. I don't know. You know, I think in the last several years, really, I'm taking a new direction with the Wilma that is starting to be talked about on the national scene. And that is that I'm trying to really get away from the institutional corporate theater making that I think we have kind of established in 1990s, you know, when the institutions were kind of modeled after corporations, when you have CEO and then, you know. And, you know, theater is a collaborative art, and the people who create the art are the actors, the artists, the writers, the designers, the directors. So for many years, I feel that there has been this emphasis on having the institution to keep on going under any kind of circumstances just for its own sake, right? But I feel, you know, that institution doesn't have to exist. The art has to exist. And if the institution, and I think I probably should not say it out loud because my board of directors will not like it, but I feel we should not be talking about, you know, does Wilma going to be existing, will be in existence 20 years from now, and how do we provide for that? I think what is more important is that we are focusing on the work now and create very exciting, unusual, original projects that will have an impact on what's happening in Philadelphia.
Blanca Ziska, what do you consider a good night in the theater?
When I go to see theater?
Yeah, when you go to see theater.
I want some complex ideas in the play, deep emotions that are explored through language. I want the actors to be connected to each other and create the work together, being tuned into each other. I'm looking at the visual world that has been created. I like humor. I like subversion, absurdity. And I also love music in the production, live music.
You shouldn't be an artistic director. You should be a theater critic.
Here we go.
I congratulate you, Blanca Ziska, on the Vilcek Foundation Prize. And it's been delightful to talk with you.
Thank you, Howie.
Blanca Ziska spoke with NewsWorks theater blogger Howard Shapiro. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Stay with WHYY at 9 this evening for NPR's ongoing presidential primary coverage. Tonight, Wisconsin takes center stage for the Democratic and Republican hopefuls. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Cooper Neurological Institute supports WHYY. Their team is available 24/7 to treat the most life-threatening and debilitating strokes or brain injuries. Cooper offers a full range of neurological and neurosurgical services, including brain surgery, endovascular neurosurgery, and epilepsy, migraine, and movement disorder care, with offices in Camden, Voorhees, and their newest location, Glassboro. To schedule an appointment, 1-800-8-COOPER or cooperhealth.org/stroke.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers with flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations. Prospective students can drop in anytime during their upcoming information sessions on Wednesday, April 6th and Wednesday, April 20th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more about the University of Delaware MBA, including information on their national ranking from PayScale at udmba.com.
Liberty In-Home Care supports WHYY, providing assistance to seniors and their families in Chester, Delaware, and Montgomery counties. Liberty In-Home Care specializes in comprehensive non-medical home care services, including personal care such as bathing and grooming, live-in care to help seniors remain independent in their homes, and companion care for exercise, meal planning, transportation, and more. All care plans are customized to the individual's needs. More information is available at libertycares.com.